Master Wayne, we're ready to take off and see this Stippin'.
Thanks, Alfred. Stippin' who? Stippin'. Sounds like some kind of Led Zeppelin track.
Well, Master Wayne, that's a bit before your time.
That's all right, Alfred. We'll just cue some great AC/DC instead. Let's go and check this alien bad guy out.
I'm the leader, Molly.
G'day, folks. How you going? Adam O'Brien here, of course. Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia for a show that I hope you're going to enjoy today. It's my spoiler-packed review of Justice League the Snyder Cut, or Zack Snyder's Justice League as he's putting it out on Binge here in Australia, or our affiliate with, of course, HBO and Foxtel, who owns it out here in Australia. I am absolutely gobsmacked, folks. We're going to talk about what I enjoyed about it, what I thought of this whole Snyderverse as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how that takes off now.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
G'day, my name is Gowan. Follow the Lethal Mullet here
on Fandom Podcast Network's master channel at fpnet.podbean.com, or subscribe on the Podbean app where you can find all the shows. Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast. Culture Clash, a weekly look at pop culture. New look at Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast. You can also check out The Mullet Guild, a look at the Dune universe from me, the Lethal Mullet. You can also check out this show and all the others, like What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast, Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, and much, much more. All on FPN. You can follow on Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and all podcatchers. Make sure you follow me, The Lethal Mullet, at The Lethal Mullet on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Now it's time for the latest action news from the cinema and martial arts movies and more, all here on the Lethal Mullet Podcast. All right, folks, a little bit of news for you about what's coming up in the next few months here on the show. We'll be going through some VHS films that are hard to find, and definitely ones that you probably haven't seen in a long, long time. One of them is called Ninja Academy, starring, of course, the weapons master himself, Gerald Okamura, and a host of others, amazing talent. This is like Police Academy meets a Shokusugi ninja film. And luckily, I was able to find a rental copy of it somewhere. Of course, VHS, very hard to find unless you're on eBay, folks. So that's one we're going to be looking at. As mentioned, we're definitely looking at Billy the Kid, the Val Kilmer film. It's quite an amazing picture for what it is, and the cast is just extraordinary. And again, it's a different take on the character in comparison to what you've probably seen with Emilio Estevez, etc. So lots coming when it comes to that sort of thing. Now, some of you listeners have asked, we're going to be looking at some of those B grades that are a little bit harder to find. Some of these that were out in the late 90s, which are science fiction, action thrillers, done by usually a B-grade action movie star and some known talent. So, in this one, stars Roddy Piper, the wrestler, Rowdy Roddy Piper from WWF days of wrestling. Of course, star also of They Live, and obviously he's a presence to himself. And also Billy Drago from The Untouchables, Pale Rider, Delta Force 2, and a couple other Chuck Norris films as well. This is, of course, Sci Fighters, and this is about a killer who escapes from a lunar penal colony and has an alien parasite inside him and makes him much deadlier. Cameron Grayson is a cop who's got to track him down, and his partner, Adrian Dunn, all help him out as well as they try and find out who this guy is. Now, this is a very much one of those low-budget sci-fi actioners, and Roddy's really good at this sort of thing because he has such a presence on screen. There's this, obviously he's not an, you know, an actor in the way that, you know, we would have today where it's all the A-list stars doing action vehicles like this. But physically he's amazing, and the performance, he always gives an honest performance, And they live. I mean, that was such an amazing performance. Hell Comes to Frogtown. Again, the comedic beats in both those films are so honest because his portrayal is no BS. It's right there on screen. But this is one of the few that, you know, it comes in that time where the 90s, where they're trying to really push out martial arts and action vehicles in the sci-fi setting. And this is one of the few that didn't quite hit the mark, but it's entertaining to watch. So we'll be looking at that, folks. Alrighty, mate. Time to go down to the pub for a pint, a chat, action movies and more. Here on the Lethal Mullet Podcast. Alright, welcome to the pub, folks. Chill back, relax, grab yourself a cold bev, and relax as we chat some DCEU and, of course, the Snyder Cut here today. Alright, let's just chill here with the mic. Got a cold bevy here, folks. And, of course, I've got my little collection here of the DCEU as per Zack Snyder's universe of the films right in front of me. And, of course, that started with back in, God, what is it now? 2013 it was when it came out. And that is, of course, Man of Steel. Going all that way back. And I still remember to this day, even before then, obviously the squabbling over the rights for Superman character. And, of course, at the time, what was happening is, of course, it was about to revert back to the original creators to get their rights back or to Superman. And so they had to knock out a new Superman film. There's been many in development from people like Tim Burton at one stage with Nicolas Cage in the role. There was also another one with McGee. I do believe that was the one that was produced by, J.J. Abrams, I believe, at the time, which was called Flyby, I think. And, of course, a lot of these we're going to, like I suppose Man of Steel has done, has changed the way that Superman's portrayed, whether it's made it more gritty or darker, take on the character more realistic in some ways. Those sort of avenues are always being looked at. And I think, you know, we had Superman Returns, which I think gets a bad rap for being what is pretty much a very, very good Superman film and a good sequel to Superman 1 and 2, even though 3 and 4 are pretty fun, folks. Come on. but, you know, again, this was different. And at the time, Henry Cavill had actually tried out for Superman Returns. So he'd tried out previously for the character, didn't get it. I think he's even tried out for James Bond as well when that was going around. But this time he was ready, and Zack Snyder wanted to take him on. Producers were, of course, the producers of the previous trilogy in the DC area, and that is, of course, the Dark Knight trilogy. Hugely successful Christopher Nolan trilogy, and they realised that after Dark Knight Rises, which is pretty much as epic as you're going to get, and as campy as you're going to get, well, maybe not campy, but it was certainly as expansive as it was going to get. I mean, there's no way he's going to put a real Robin in there as far as in the costume and stuff like that in his films. But you got one in Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And you got Bane. And you got all these other characters. And, you know, it basically brought everything back. But at the time, I remember reading Empire magazine out here, the Australian edition, and they were talking about how they could continue. Obviously, at the time, they were looking at Superman, and obviously extending that out into more films and stuff like that. And the fact that Snyder was coming in to direct it. Now, Snyder, obviously, we'd known from 300, amazing adaptation to Frank Miller's work. Obviously, he'd done 2009 to date, before I personally think this film is now probably better. Watchmen was an amazing achievement and still is just one of the best comic adaptations. Has possibly the better ending than Alan Moore's original. I think the work that went into that was just absolutely sublimely beautiful. And the casting, everything down to, you know, the execution of it was just bang on perfect. And really had a renewed interest from a lot of people in that property, even though there had been a Terry Gilliam edition that was being put together and others as well at the time. Obviously, we've had a TV show since on HBO, and again, it's just renewed interest in it. It's because of Zack's film. Zack's film was so bang on the buck perfect, in my you know, thoughts. So, coming to obviously bringing his new vision. Now, he envisioned a 5-film saga that would bring us right through. And the through line, of course, is Kal-El himself, Superman. And in this, we get to really see a different Krypton, one that kind of got expanded on in the Krypton TV series, even though it's really not tied to it. It's close, but not quite. What we get is this alien civilization that is basically on borrowed time. They've had the kind of technology we would have. We keep going, I suppose. We become a space-faring culture. But even theirs has gone to a stage where it's just lost its luster, lost its power. And again, somebody that's, you know, as a people, they have got to a stage where their growing populations have gone ridiculously huge, and they have had not had a natural birth on their planet, apart from the cloning and stuff that they're doing for the society in many hundreds of years. That's when, of course, Kal-El comes in as the first one in many years, and obviously first proper son of Krypton in many generations. Of course, that film is really interesting because, again, it's an alien come to another world. It's a man out of time sort of sequence as well, I suppose. Little bits of ties to things like Captain America and Back to the Future and stuff like that happens when you bring those characters through. But it's also, in the case of Kal-El, him learning of what it is to be human through these five films. And he's basically a god with his powers. Not on Krypton, but obviously through the sun's rays in our system, empowers a Kryptonian to that extent. So again, this is an interesting sort of take on it, very realistic take, particularly in the battles, the Battle of Metropolis, you know, the way that that plays out. Obviously, it plays out, it spills over into the next film because we get to see the effects of that on Wayne Enterprises and, of course, Bruce Wayne. But I thought Man of Steel as a whole, you know, as it came out, you know, I liked it for what it was. I thought it was really interesting. I think the Kevin Costner role and, of course, playing Pa Kent, and, of course, we had Russell Crowe yeah, playing Jor-El. Interesting casting. Obviously, Lois Lane, Amy Adams, pretty good in it, I thought. And, you know, overall, it was a really well orchestrated film. But I think as a singular film, it works better than part of the whole that we're getting. Because I found BVS a little bit disjointed. Not until the Ultimate Edition came out that I really understood what Zack was trying to put together. And again, like the Justice League film, he needs time to really tell his stories. So as BVS came out, we saw obviously the reaction that Batman had. Basically, Bruce Wayne had to what happened to Metropolis, and then in turn, the worlds of Gotham City and vice versa. Ben Affleck is the Batman, folks. He is the Batman. Like, he's really made it his part to play the middle-aged Batman, and it does an extremely amazing job in the role. He really is the scene stealer in that entire movie. When it's Batman v Superman, there's a reason why Batman's first there, because he really is knocking it out of the park. I think, again, Henry's great in that one too, but Batman steals the performances, whether it's from the work of Jeremy Irons as Alfred, this sort of a bit more militaristic version of the character, a bit younger too than, say, Kane was and stuff like that. But really ran through well. I still don't like Lex Luthor, folks, in this one. I don't think it was portrayed quite right. I think it needed somebody a little bit, I like that he was playing it as a modern Luthor. I do like that, but it's not my favorite version of the character. But overall, that film, again, too, rang sort of a grittier tone and really amped up, obviously, what we were getting as we headed towards the battle with Doomsday. But, of course, Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman steals that movie at the end when she comes through the film, stealing little scenes here and there, little espionage that goes through. But when we finally see her as Wonder Woman at the end, she not only does she save the other two, but she saves the film, in my idea. And, of course, this is the dawn of justice, so it really opens up what we're getting. Again, it still feels fairly small scale in comparison to where we're heading, because it's really more about Batman and Superman's confrontation, getting to know each other, finding out who they are, and the whole, Martha! Martha, why'd you say that name? Well, Looking back on it now, I thought it was a bit funny when we first saw it back in, 2016. But looking back on it now, it actually works. It works actually quite well. This is part of Snyder, and I suppose his genius, is that he does like to change things. That, of course, led into a myriad of other films that came around. Obviously, we've had Wonder Woman, brilliant opening film for that character. Then we had also Aquaman, arguably probably the best DC film to date in terms of getting that larger audience. Obviously, since then, we've also had Suicide Squad, which I think is a bit of a misunderstood film. I didn't like the villains in that film, but I liked the rogues gallery of characters that we had right through from Will Smith all the way through. Harley Quinn, even Jared Leto's Joker, although I really prefer him in the version that we're seeing on screen right now. Even as far as, the sort of style that they went for, which was different, it's kind of like more of a street punk Joker, but it worked. Folks, it worked. And the tying into Batman at the start, going after Deadshot, is really well done. I like it. So for me, that film, as well as the other two, when those sort of came out together, that really just, boom, you get that one level. And I think it's a film a little bit like Justice League that's been kind of spoiled by the heads of DC by coming in and trying to change things and have their little say. Again, I suppose it's their film. They can do that. But I want to see David Ayer's actual vision for it. So release the David Ayer cut. The Ayer cut, folks. We want that. All right, folks. This is the time. This is the time to talk about Zack Snyder's most amazing effort, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I'm talking about a director who I've really enjoyed the work of, probably everything except for Sucker Punch. It's the only one that, is still good, but wasn't of the same level as Watchmen and 300, which really lit the fires for me. Like, that was just an amazing set of adaptations. They were very interesting visually, but at the same time made me want to read those books again. Go back to enjoying the work of Frank Miller. Always have enjoyed Frank Miller's work, and I think he's an absolute genius when it comes to comics material and stuff like that. But Zack's really gone out and made what I think is a real interesting film here. Obviously, he had a continuing story that he was trying to tell, and won over five films, which would really show a generation of heroes, and obviously encapsulate many more that were to come. Like, obviously, things like Green Lanterns would have come in, and The Martian Manhunter, which is in this one too. That is a light spoiler, folks. But from here on, you have been warned. We are going full spoilers, folks, so I hope you're ready. You may think you know Justice League. You may think you know it because it had a theatrical cut that went out a few years ago with the director Joss Whedon. And obviously, most of us have seen that one. And it was not the kind of film we were expecting. It was a much lighter film than what Zack had envisioned and what we'd seen from, obviously, Batman versus Superman and Man of Steel. And it certainly wasn't the sort of story itself that we hoped it would be. If anything, it was light. The villains weren't quite there with terms of story. Certainly didn't have Darkseid in there. It was all about Steppenwolf, but even Steppenwolf wasn't given much to do. In this edition, which is 4 hours long, 4 hours feels like maybe 2.5, maybe even 2 hours. It goes that quickly. And I must say, I enjoyed it. So, in Australia, to view this one, we had to go onto the Binge streaming channel. This is one that's part of, I think, Foxtel, if I remember correctly. Foxtel runs all the shows here in Australia that are owned by HBO. And, of course, obviously Warner Brothers and that sort of thing. You can usually find those shows later on, whether it's streaming through Apple TV. That way you actually have to buy the series themselves or movies, whatever it is. So there is access to things, but it's usually after they've been streaming for a fair while.
So you won't see them on preview or, in this case, on its debut. With Binge, though, Binge, you've got all of those shows and more. So this is the access that you need. Now, here in Australia, you have a whole gamut of different Warner Brothers material through this. And, of course, all those ones that we've had on Foxtel for years, now accessible through streaming devices and obviously through smart TVs. So hats off to them. It's great. The only drawback I find that it doesn't seem to go to high definition for too long. It seems to be jumping back and forwards in some of the time. The running time itself could be due to situations where the signal's not strong enough, all that sort of stuff. So you've got to kind of factor that in. Your internet connection as well has to be pretty decent to be able to get this. And it is a hell of an image when you do get it right. It's amazing. So the film itself starts out just like the other one, but we're getting a lot of more backstory in this, not only of the characters, but we also see a backstory in this that sort of opens up pretty much bang on where we left things in the previous film. So you get to see the effects of Doomsday, obviously getting killed by Clark Kent, Kal-El slash Superman. And when we see that, we sort of see this wave effect from Superman calling out as he perishes as well in the killing of Doomsday. And as he sacrifices himself, that wave goes through all the different worlds. So as it goes around the globe, we start to see the different parts, whether it's the Mascara, which we land on at the end of it, but we also see, obviously, all the different parts of Metropolis, little bits of, I do believe it was Gotham City in there as well. But it's a nice way to tie in things to bring them, wrap them up together like that too. So that was interesting. And in that, we also have parts that we're missing from the Whedon film. Now, if there's one thing that I do miss from the Whedon version of this, is the whole Batman on the top of a skyscraper, basically dangling a carrot, that the carrot being the criminal. And, of course, that is an actor who you'll see in a lot of material, folks. So I want you to go and look him up because he's worth it. You can see him in Losers. He's also in Alien 3. He's also in The Search for One-Eyed Jimmy. There you go. There's a film to track down. A great movie, too. There's also him in the last Jack Reacher that was done as well. He played one of the villain characters in that. But the main thing is that dangling the carrot like that and, you know, having Batman sort of almost going around like the animated series, even less so than I think Whedon's little add-on there was it to try and kind of like be the Burton Batman style. But we don't have that in this. We go straight pretty much to Themyscira, where we have one of the mother boxes being guarded by the warriors there. And as we have the villain literally teleport himself in there to try and take it, and take it he does. And that is, of course, Steppenwolf, played by Kieran Hines. And he's amazing in this. This version with a more realized CGI version of it, we get to see the character far more alien, which is, I think, yeah, again, the intention to show that this is somebody from another universe, right? And I think we get to feel that the powerful sort of strides and everything in this far more than the more, I suppose, especially I look back on the theatrical version, you know, it was far more human-like in the face and stuff like that. So it didn't have quite the slightly more linear style of the face, but also the horns and stuff like that of Steppenwolf are quite different in this too. Love it, love the detail, but he's really commanding presence with the parademons, and the parademons look amazing in this version. They actually look like a real threat, not just some, you know, cutesy pie fly that's put in there that Batman's just going to take out and get swatted by Aquaman or the Flash, Cyborg or Wonder Woman. So we've got that too, but what I really enjoy about this is the time that's taken, particularly in the first hour. Now, this is, film is made up in six parts, so you can watch it episodically if you need to, but if you're like me, you just kick back with a nice meal, a hot cup of coffee, and watch this. It really plays out quite well. And I really, as I said earlier, before this, spoiler area, we're talking about Snyder's somebody that's really, you know, if he was a novel writer, he'd be writing those big 1,000-page epics. You know, he's that sort of person that's like Tad Williams, the fantasy writer who writes big epic tomes, or, you know, something along the lines of, I suppose, of Frank Herbert when he's writing Dune. It's that epic scale, giving you time, giving you the weight to add to characters because they've got a backstory. They've got a need to do stuff. In this, Steppenwolf is given the time. Steppenwolf is somebody who's definitely been on the wrong side of Darkseid, the ultimate villain in this. You know, this is this character who's just a plunderer of worlds, looking for the anti-life equation, which we'll get into later. But of course, he's somebody that wants to mend his ways so he can be accepted by Darkseid and, of course, Darkseid's minions. This is the new gods versus the old gods, which is another thing we get to see in this as well. Far more of that flashback area. So it is well played out, well mapped out. And after we see this, we get to see the Wonder Woman sequence that we saw. So we know that Zack definitely shot this footage, not Joss. And it's head to, obviously, London, UK, where we get to see the big heist. Now, what's great about this one plays out far better than the cuts that we saw in the theatrical. This has the kind of heavyweight feel of a Nolan film. If anything, a little bit like, a couple of people have mentioned this, the start of Dark Knight has that sort of temptation. A little less on the terms of scale and stuff like that, I suppose, but it still has that power. And we really get to see Wonder Woman in her element in this, and far better than in the second film, Wonder Woman 1984, which is very mediocre, in my opinion. The first film was far better. But in this, you know, the theme that's got that sort of siren quality to the theme that Junkie XL's sort of pushing. As it gets, you know, she gets more into the action, the music kicks in higher, faster. And I love it because you really get that feel that, you know, this is a warrior, but also one that is a hero as well, hero of the people. And it's great because in that scene too, after she dispatches the villains, she has a young girl look up to her and, you know, it's that great moment that we all like to see in superhero films when you have a character like Wonder Woman, have obviously young children or even just young teens aspire to be like them. And of course, set the ball in motion for them to be heroes of the future, which is fantastic. Then we also have, obviously, the story of Cyborg. Now, Cyborg really is the heart and soul of this film. The work done in this by Ray Fisher is amazing. I can see exactly why he's passionate about this film. Not only has he put his heart and soul in, he's really given us a character that's a through line. As much as each of them have a part in that team, you know, the character is hiding a mother box. So the one that obviously they're all after, because we have Steppenwolf early in the film, dispatch the one obviously from Themyscira, and then he goes to Atlantis and says, you know what, that's mine, I'm going to take that. And we get to see that. So before we go into that, we'll talk about Atlantis too. The scenes that Zack's done in here, obviously we involve Jason Momoa's character, Arthur Curry. We get to see at the start Batman hunting him down in the small fishing village. And it plays out differently, but I think plays out with the less forced laughs or the jokes themselves. And it's done well. If anything, there's a respect immediately to a point between Arthur Curry and Bruce Wayne in this version. But there's also a certain epicness. I kind of can see parts of Batman Begins, particularly when they're in Iceland, at the start there, when we have the likes of Alfred turning up. And it's the same feel and scene afterwards where Curry turns them down and then obviously Bruce is getting the plane back to Gotham City. And we have that great scene with Jeremy Irons. Now, the one thing I will say, Jeremy's not that much older than Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck would be, what, late 40s, early 50s, if most. And Jeremy's only between a 15 to 20 year difference. There's always been a far older Alfred, I think, in the previous editions. So what's great about this point is that Jeremy Irons himself, obviously, is somebody that's quite fit, looks the part, looks like a military officer, And I think that's what they're really pushing here is that, you know, Alfred was definitely military in the past. So that really plays out quite well. If anything, quite impressed with his portrayal of Alfred. It's fun. There's laughs where there needs to be, but nothing forced. So, when the Age of Heroes chapter really kicks in, we get to see, obviously, Batman kind of do what he did in the theatrical, where he's going around to, like he did with, obviously, Arthur Curry, try to get them to join the team. So, with Wonder Woman's help, Wonder Woman goes after, obviously, Cyborg, after she's contacted by him in the Batcave. So, she obviously sees that Cyborg is able to manipulate the digital platform like that and contact her. And then obviously they meet, but also at the same time, Bruce Wayne is meeting, of course, Ezra Miller's Flash. And again, the sequence is different. Even though obviously same scene in the theatrical, which I think wasn't shot quite as well, or at least the angles or whatever they were using with Whedon's cut. In this one, it plays less for laughs, even though the laughs that are there are more sincere and Bruce Wayne's a lot more on the money. But I think what the great scene is, particularly the way Affleck plays it, still in both cuts, is the scene where, well, what's your superpower? I'm rich. That's kind of the feeling you get, even if Christian Bale was saying that in the Nolan universe of Batman, so the Dark Knight trilogy. It's got the same sort of laugh as, you know, I'm not wearing hockey pants, all that sort of stuff. So it plays out quite well. But again, he's going to be that character that they go central to for that. And of course, he's got such a big part in this. Ezra's role in this, in particular, as the Flash, is interesting because the Flash obviously has the chance to manipulate time. And that's what makes that character really, really interesting. And we get to see the backstory of that too. We get to see that he's already trying to help people. The Flash is trying to use that, obviously, power that he has for the betterment of his, city, stuff like that. But also what's great about it is we can also see the Flash has the power to speed things up quite far further than we thought. And that goes into, obviously, to meeting his father in prison, and that is, of course, Billy Crudup, Dr. Manhattan himself from The Watchmen. Great to see. Obviously, there's been a lot of Watchmen crossovers in terms of the castings. Obviously, Batman's father in it, the comedian from Watchmen, Jeffrey Dean Morgan. And that's great. Obviously, that was in Batman v Superman as well. So it's great. We get to see that sort of get together when we finally see J.K. Simmons as, of course, Commissioner Gordon on top of the roof with the bat signal, calling in, of course, Batman and the rest of the team. So that's great. As we have this happen, we also have Steppenwolf get visited by his bosses. Now, this is not something that was in the original theatrical that went out. So Steppenwolf really is at a loss. He's not able to state the same perception as the minions of Darkseid, as they're obviously being far more successful in their careers as villains, I suppose. But in this, you know, we really get to see it build and grow, and particularly as a team. You know, Darkseid obviously has taken out, as he says, hundreds of thousands of worlds and, you know, turned them to dust, or in his version of beauty, I suppose, because he turns them into pretty much his own world, Apocalypse, same, a clone of. But, of course, the stepping stones to get him back in the likes of course, of Darkseid, is that he's going to be able to show that their anti-life equation, anti-life itself, is here on Earth. So straight away, once he lets his boss know, his boss is like, well, you need to get those mother boxes together and get things happening. So the whole crux of the story is to get that box. And the box, obviously, owned by one of the only Cyborg. Now, what's a really interesting part of the casting of these films is, of course, Joe Morton playing the father of Cyborg. Now, just think about that, folks. Back in the early 1990s, a certain movie came out, directed by James Cameron. It was a sequel, an absolutely rip-roaring success, one that was obviously big game changer in terms of visual effects. That is, of course, Terminator 2 Judgment Day, which had, of course, Joe Morton playing Miles Bennett Dyson. Now, this is the character that worked for basically Skynet, put everything together in taking from the old Terminator from 1984 and carried it through and tried to basically reverse engineer their first Terminator. And he was well on his way to do it. But then, of course, he helped Sarah Connor destroy it and bring it all down. So in some ways, he's the father of the Terminators. In this, he's the father of Cyborg. He creates a Cyborg. So it's interesting, you know, to bring that sort of full circle, I suppose, in some ways. But it's interesting casting because he's an amazing actor, as is, of course, Ray Fisher as Cyborg. And the scenes are quite good. I always thought that those scenes were ones I'd probably just skip through. But no, it's well played out and it's central to, obviously, the story itself as well. So we obviously have some of the other beats where we have the parademons and stuff working underground. And this is where we get to see Batman pull together at least part of the team as they're trying to track down Steppenwolf. And they see him for the first time underground. And we get to see that weird caterpillar-like bat vehicle that he's got down there, which is still looks weird to me, but it kind of looks cool. It's like a huge spider, almost. And, of course, we get to see Alfred playing behind the controls of that one via a drone style. So, obviously, a little bit like he did with the Batwing and Batman v Superman as well, too. So, interesting play out, and we get to see them all work together. The highlight, of course, is Wonder Woman as Gal Gadot goes through and pretty much does as much damage as she can. And, of course, Steppenwolf does more taunting in this. So you really want to take him out. You know, he's particularly in this version far more rich in terms of the fact that he really wants this. He wants an end given to these characters. And, you know, he kind of gets there close to it at least. After these amazing experiences on that level, we also have the mother box being hidden, obviously, by the father of Cyborg. And it is now revealed that that is what was used to resurrect the character and become the character of Cyborg. What is the power of the mother box, even though they did not fully understand the alien technology? So it's central as a living machine to becoming some of these amazing characters that we see. Obviously, too, that it was going to be the linchpin for some of the things moving forward as well, as we have characters like Lex Luthor that we're going to use this sort of technology. As it moves on and moving to the climax of the picture, we have very similar to the theatrical where the character of Steppenwolf has made his own lair where, of course, all of the mother boxes are collected and we're starting to create the unity that he needed, which was going to put it back in stead with, of course, people from Apocalypse and Darkseid. Part of the characters getting together in Justice League itself was how they were going to topple Steppenwolf. And of course, part of that was bringing back Kal-El, Clark Kent, Superman. And in this version, we get that. And of course, he's not quite the character yet. As they go to, obviously, the scout ship in Metropolis, we get the characters using the mother box to then create life again out of the deceased body and of their friend Kal-El. This plays out similar to the theatrical. Obviously, they go to that place and through the scout ship and the use of Flash being able to generate so much power. His speed and, of course, the Cyborg's calculations, they are able to resurrect Superman, who doesn't quite know who he is just yet. It's definitely a rebirth of the character. And, of course, we get to see him in his black uniform, which is, of course, the regeneration suit. So he's still regenerating through this movie in that suit, which if you've seen the old comics, you'll understand what that is. But gone is the hair on the lip and the CGI
to remove that from, of course, Henry Cavill doing his work on Mission Impossible. When he was doing that, obviously had the moustache and the reshoots, of course, as Joss Whedon was putting together his cut of the film. And again, it plays out a lot better, less comedy, and definitely a lot tougher. Actually, the entire sequence in and around, obviously, of the end, where we see Steppenwolf get taken down a few pegs by each of the characters, and whether it fares from Batman down, there's less quips and more action. The action itself's a lot cleaner than I expected, and definitely the CGI is far better. A little bit more polished. Then there's some parts that aren't quite so polished, but it's kind of forgivable heading into, obviously, this HBO streaming format. And, of course, with the end of Steppenwolf in this, we then have the team coming back together, and, of course, Superman now part of it once again, even though he's still trying to figure out who he is. Now, to top it off, at the end we get a bit of a coda to this story where we jump forward into the nightmare sequence. And again, this is a dream that Bruce Wayne is having, where we see him getting together with Deathstroke. We get to see the characters of the Joker there as well. And of course, we see Cyborg as well, and some other characters. But what is interesting about it is, as the characters are all come together, they all have to rely on each other, whether it's good or bad, to take on Darkseid. And, of course, Superman, who has now turned to Darkseid's side. So this is kind of a cliffhanger left there, and definitely bringing together, of course, Jared Leto's Joker and, of course, Bruce Wayne. And they had quite an interesting sequence. Didn't expect that we'd get that, especially in this film. And it's amazing. But you also get to see Martian Manhunter at the end as well, who's been watching from afar and was one of the military characters in Man of Steel in his shape-shifting format. So he's been there for quite a while, and that reveal was fantastic. So overall, this film excelled as far as my expectations, and I always think that's the case majority of the time when a director is left to their own devices and given their own cut. There's some great films out there with that in mind. And a lot of them are longer cuts, sometimes shorter, depending on the director. In this case, Zack Snyder is definitely a storyteller that needs a longer form. It's proven time and again, whether it's The Watchmen in the director's cut or even the Ultimate Cut, which I haven't had a chance to watch yet. But that's got the Tales from the Black Freighter in there, the comic within the comic. Along with all the deleted scenes in the director's cut added to something I would definitely want to check out, that full version of the piece. But also, you know, you look at this edition too, it definitely shows that there's definitely a lot more story there, a lot more central, particularly in the characters of The Flash, definitely the characters of Steppenwolf and Cyborg as well. And definitely better depictions of the characters of the Batman. Superman to a lesser degree, because I think he feels like he's less in this than the other version as well. And of course, Wonder Woman, given a much better chance of this. Overall, I think this is a far more approved film, improved in many ways. But what I think is the interesting thing is, if I look back at Justice League, which is probably on my scale out of 5, in the Hallenbach scale, about a 2, maybe 2 out of 5. This is definitely up in the 4s, 4 out of 5. You know, there's definitely still, I think, you know, as long as it is, I think there's still room for Zack to have trimmed this a little bit further. But in the streaming format, this is great and definitely gets a 4 out of 5.
G'day, folks. Hope you're enjoying the great shows here on the Phantom Podcast Network. Be sure to check out all the great shows that we have on offer and subscribe on the master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. You can check Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd Rysel and Lee Fillingsus on their platform. You can also check out Culture Clash, which is the weekly look at pop culture hosted by Kevin and Kyle. Couch Potato Theatre, this is a cult classics and guilty pleasure podcast. Also Time Warp, a fandom flashback show. Endzone, a look at the NFL, the American football. Also Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, looking at the great films of Alfred Hitchcock. Union Federation podcast, a Star Trek and Orville podcast, looking at Discovery and, of course, Picard, plus the Orville. Also, the Hair Metal podcast, looking at the great shows put on by the amazing bands back in the late 80s, their discs, their LPs, everything, all covering the fashion as well. Hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel. You can also check out Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, hosted by Kevin and Dan Hadley, looking at all the eras of Doctor Who. You can also catch out What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast, an amazing show looking at Star Wars, hosted by Derek and Scott. And of course, our newest one, the amazing, The Mullet Guild, an offshoot of the Lethal Mullet podcast looking at Frank Herbert's Dune universe. This is like an encyclopedia for Dune, where I take you through and down into the rabbit hole of Frank Herbert's amazing space opera, the sprawling universe which is going to be brought to life by Denis Villeneuve and December 18. You can check out all the shows there. Be sure to also go onto the social platforms on Twitter at FanPod Network. Let us know what you think of the shows and what else you can look at there. You can also check out great articles that we put up through there that we share. Also check out on Instagram and Facebook, Fandom Podcast Network. Be sure to make sure that every Tuesday you check out the great work done by Making Treks as well. A brand new podcast looking at a deep dive of Star Trek, hosted by myself, James Semple, and of course, the ever popular and amazing writer of Star Trek and Star Wars, Mark Newbold. Go and check it out, folks, and we'll catch you next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network's The Lethal Mullet Podcast. Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.